This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Sub 70 Podcast. This is Jay. It is March 30th, and the second round of the Houston Open is currently taking place. We are less than 1 week from the 2018 Masters, which is probably one of the most hyped up and interesting Masters in recent memory and possibly ever. You have a whole bunch of guys that have sort of bounced back this year, getting victories, including Bubba Watson, who already has two very high caliber wins, Rory McIlroy, Phil Mickelson. You have the whole Tiger Woods comeback story. He's been playing well. Then you got the young guys. Justin Thomas has been playing well. Jordan Spieth has been struggling a bit, but it's Augusta and you can't never count him out there. John Rahm, Tommy Fleetwood. I mean, the list goes on and on. Obviously, Sergio is coming back to try to defend his title. It's just ridiculously stacked. There are so many different storylines and possible players that could compete for the green jacket. We're looking forward to that. We'll probably have a recap up afterward. This episode, though, is our interview with Hal Sutton. Hal is one of the all-time great PGA Tour players. He has 14 PGA Tour victories, including a PGA Championship. He was involved with 5 different Ryder Cups. Just an all-time great. He talked about growing up golfing, what his sort of path to the PGA Tour was. Also talked about how expectations and his mentality really changed after his third victory, which was the PGA Championship. He won tournaments from the early 80s all the way until the year 2001, where he actually won the Houston Open. So unbelievable career, really cool talk. He talks about the Ryder Cups. He talks about his resurgence in the around the year 2000, where he actually beat Tiger at the Players in 2000, which is an incredible feat considering how Tiger Woods was just absolutely dominating every tournament he was in at that point. And then he also talks about his transition over to being a teacher and a coach, which he is really, really enjoying these days. So here is the interview. Hope you guys enjoy it. I would like to welcome to the podcast 14-time PGA Tour winner, PGA champion, Ryder Cup member, Ryder Cup captain, and the list goes on and on, Hal Sutton to the podcast. Hal, thank you very much for being on the podcast today. I appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
Well, I think we need to add the word coach to the list on the introduction as well. My first question is, how did the Hal Sutton Golf Academy come about, and how are you enjoying your role as a teacher and an instructor?
It's been something that I've wanted to do all my life. You know, as a player, I was always curious about what people thought about the golf swing, and like every kid that there is out there today, thought that there was a correct way to swing the club and, you know, a perfect way, if you will. And so I worked with a lot of different people on my own. And then after I quit playing, I decided I was going to start teaching kids because I've learned without a shadow of a doubt that there's no perfect way to do this. There is your way. And, you know, as young people and kids, we follow whoever we're watching at the time, and we think that they're doing it the perfect way, and they are doing it the perfect way for them, but that's not always your perfect way.
Do you have any certain philosophies of the golf swing or teaching that you're adamant with your students, or is it sort of a situation where you're going to take with the natural ability this person has and then sort of mold that into getting them to be the best player that they can be?
Well, I think that the latter is more of what I try to do. You know, we try to take whatever their natural abilities are and nudge them in the direction of some fundamentals that I know for sure are part of the game. you know, in the quest for distance that everybody's been after. You know, we've gotten to where we're using the nth degree of lower body to try to create a lot of speed. And a lot of times when you overuse your lower body, you tend to slow your arms down. The club gets behind you, your spine backs up, and consequently it becomes an ineffective way of playing golf.
So with your role as a teacher, you've kind of given up the Champions Tour at this point on a full-time basis. Do you miss being out there with the guys, and do you miss that competition?
Well, you know, when you've competed at the highest level and you've done things that make people stand on their feet and cheer for you, you know, you miss that part of it. But there's a lot of aspects of the tour that I don't miss at all. The travel and the there's just a lot of aspects I don't really miss. But, you know, I chased my own personal dream for a long time, and there's a lot more to life than what we all personally set as goals. And I enjoy helping kids chase their dreams. It's something that I spend overtime thinking about how to help these kids, you know. And I tell all the kids, you know, if you found somebody that they're thinking about you when you're not there, then that person cares enough to really do his best to help you with your golf swing.
And looking back at your career when you were a young player, you had a tremendous career in college. At what point did you know you were going to be a professional golfer, or that was going to be your career path while you were in school? Was it earlier in your career in college, or was it later?
Well, I was like every other kid. You know, when I went into college, I dreamed about playing the tour. But, you know, it was probably my senior year before I felt like I had enough talent that I felt like I could really do it. And, you know, I didn't turn pro immediately. I worked for a year after I got out of college. So,
and then when you did turn professional, what was your pathway to the PGA Tour? Did you do the mini tour thing, or did you go to Q School immediately back then, when I know they used to have two Q schools? Or how did you get your pathway onto the tour at that point?
I went to the Q School one time. The finals were at Waterwood National, just north of Houston, and I got through it the first time.
And then you get your first win at the Walt Disney pretty early in your career. What does that do for a young professional? Or how? I mean, it's got to be the greatest feeling in the world to win at the highest level, and then your career sort of gets set at that point with knowing the tournament schedule you're going to play, and it has to make a huge difference, I would imagine.
I mean, Walt Disney World was the last tournament of the year season, and I had been close both the 2 weeks prior to that and didn't get it done. And, you know, to finish the year out with the win like that really set me up to have a big season in 83, which was my biggest year probably.
And, yeah, to get to 83, and we have to talk about the win at the PGA Championship at Riviera Historic Golf Course. You lead all three rounds going into the fourth round. What's that pressure like leading in a major championship, and then on Sunday you got a guy named Nicklaus kind of chasing at you?
Well, it was a lot of pressure, but 2 weeks prior to that, I lost a six-shot lead on Sunday in Anheuser-Busch, and, you know, I didn't want that to define. Really felt like I was really ready to play and, you know, opened the tournament with 65 and then 66 and ended up having a four-shot lead going into number 12, and I bogeyed three straight holes, 12, 13, and 14, to go from a four-shot lead to a one-shot lead, and certainly didn't want that to define me, so I had to pick myself up by the bootstraps and go on.
And then when you get over that finish line and they hand you the Wanamaker, that feeling must be incredible. And then also, as a young professional, it has to take some pressure off to kind of free you up a little bit, that you've kind of hit that notch, right? You have a major championship. You're a part of history. They can't take it away. Has to be an incredible feeling, even to this day, to know that, you know, you're a part of history. You own a major.
Well, yes, and that's where the expectations started at a much higher level, too, you know, and everybody in the world, you know, I played golf for Hal Sutton at that point, and then all of a sudden I felt like I was playing for the rest of the world. You know, we live in a judgmental world, and everybody's passing judgment as to whether you're succeeding or failing, And I can't even imagine what it's like now with social media and everything else, and a difficult way to go through life. But, you know, I struggled after that because of I wasn't sure. I kind of ventured back. I wasn't sure if that's really what I wanted to do. You know, I played the game because I enjoyed the game and loved the game. And all of a sudden now it became a serious responsibility living up to everybody else's expectations.
Yeah, and you probably, as you don't think of that until it probably happens, correct? I had a conversation with Sean McKeel, and he sort of said the same thing, that life really changes after you have that major championship. It's wonderful on one side, but there's challenges that come with it of living up to that standard and when's the next one and all that kind of stuff. It's got to be tough at some level as well.
Extremely.
Just curious, too, where do you keep your Wanamaker, and is it fun for you to show that to people and let them put their hands on it and sort of hold that piece of history? Do you get joy out of other people seeing the trophy and talking about that championship?
I keep a lot of the trophies that I won at the Academy so that kids can see it, but, you know, kids aren't interested in that. You know, they don't care about those trophies and stuff, and you know, I can't honestly say that I've seen anybody looking at it. You know, they're chasing their own dreams.
Well, let's talk about the Ryder Cup. You played on four teams in 85, 87, and then later in your career as well. How was that experience at the 85 Ryder Cup? And I ask this with, at that period of time, the Americans usually won it in a landslide. And then, which I think actually made the Ryder Cup what it is today, that Europe started bouncing back a little bit. How was your experience during that first one, and just kind of looking back, what are your thoughts on your first couple Ryder Cups, and what's that like to experience that and play in such a prestigious event?
Well, the captain in 85 was Lee Trevino, and, you know, to make the 85 team was really a dream come true. I dreamed about playing on the Ryder Cup, you know, and so it was an experience. I never really understood what it felt like to play for your country, and you know, golf is such an individual sport, to finally come together where an individual performance adds up to a part of a team performance is unique for a golfer. You know, we do that with stroke play in college, not match play for the most part. And so it was very unique, and I can't say that I played very – I didn't play terrible, but I didn't play good in 85, a little bit in awe of the whole experience. Then in 87, you know, Nicklaus was the captain, and I played really well in 87. I was I scored the most points that year in 87 of any American, even though we lost. And then in 99, I was 12 years removed from making the team. I scored the most points that year in 99. That's 3.5 points. So, you know, I had a couple of years there where I had a pretty good record as a Ryder Cup player. So,
was that event in 99 on Sunday the most special thing you've ever been part of as a professional golfer? That had to be absolutely crazy out there, of the home crowd and the momentum, and Crenshaw the night before saying he has a feeling. Was that? I mean, I can't imagine what that experience must have been like to play in it. It had to be incredible.
Well, it was. It was probably the most electric sporting event that I was ever part of. On Sunday there, the first six players, we all started out in a dominant fashion. All of us were way up, and the electricity in the air suggested that the Americans are rolling and we might actually win. And from being four down, that was, you know, no one thought we had a chance but us. You know, to be part of that team is something that I look back on very fondly.
Was there any European players that you truly enjoyed competing against out of all those guys from, you know, you kind of played against two different generations of European players who were on the Ryder Cup, but was there a couple of guys that you just could not wait to mix it up with? You loved the competition between them.
Well, you know, in 87, Larry Mize and I played Seve and Olathabal, and we were the first to ever beat them, and that was a lot of fun. You know, the Spaniards are really hard to beat. They go down with a ship, and they do whatever it takes to win, and so that was one of those times where it was really exciting and fun to be able to beat the Wizard, Mr. Ballesteros there. And then in 99, playing Colin Montgomery and Paul Laurie, Jeff Maggard and I played them, and we beat them. And, you know, it's always, I mean, Colin's quite the colorful character and quite the player under pressure. And it was fun beating them, too. So those are two things that stand out, yeah.
Did Seve play the mind games with you and the his reputation of kind of trying to get under your guys' skin on top of being a great golfer? He kind of played those tough guy games. Did he pull any stuff on you guys like that, or was he pretty much just playing golf and sticking to it that way?
Well, that was Seve. You know, that was part of that was Seve's 15th club, and you know, you just had to understand that when you played Seve that he was going to be that way. And the people that ever beat him understood that. And, you know, it was expected rather than unexpected.
And then in 2004, you're the Ryder Cup captain. And my question is that is how hard is it to go from playing, which you know, were playing in the one before that, to being a captain, not really having the control? You sort of just lay the best plans out there, but you know, one guy's going to win and one guy's going to lose. Is that a difficult thing for a captain to sort of, you guys are used to being in charge or having a say in it with your clubs and your play, and now it's sort of a different role. So obviously I'm assuming you enjoyed the captaincy role, but it has to be difficult at times as well.
Oh, yeah. You know, with your clubs, you have some control over what's going on. Without any clubs, you have no control over what's going on. You know, and some might say, well, yeah, you do, but in actuality, no, you don't. And the truth of the matter is, the best laid plans in the world, if someone's not playing good, aren't going to do any good. You know, it's kind of a hit or miss or a guess. Being a Ryder Cup captain, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I just think it would be such a, you know, because a lot of the Ryder Cup captains are removed for 10 years from, you know, playing their best golf, and you were playing your best golf. I just think that'd be a very difficult thing to go from top player to all of a sudden putting the clubs aside and saying, I'm just going to captain this thing. And like I said, you put the plans out there, but I'm assuming part of you still wants to compete in there, even though you know you can't, you're a captain.
Well, in retrospect, you know, it's easy to, hindsight's 20/20. You know, I wished I would have waited a couple of years, and you know, you have no idea of knowing whether they would have asked you again. You know, I was 46 years old when they asked me, and actually had played pretty well in my 40s, you know. So in hindsight, I wished I would have said, no, it's too early for me to do this, y'all ask somebody else or whatever. But you know, you play your whole life to be asked to do something like that, and you're not sure if you'll ever be asked again. So I made the decision to do it. And, you know, it wasn't long after that I said, you know, I don't even want to play golf anymore. After the Ryder Cup was over with, I was pretty much like, you know what, I'm just going to ride off into the oblivion and go do my own thing for a while. So
no, it's got to be a tough situation, because he said somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. And like I said, you could second guess stuff for every captaincy on both sides forever. And you know, it's a tough situation for the guy who doesn't win it on either side of the ocean. It's like I said, the pressure's got to be immense. Also, I know in 2000 you played on a President's Cup team. Is the pressure or the feel of the event close to a Ryder Cup, or is Ryder Cup still way above that as far as, you know, the feelings or the pressure or the magnitude of it?
In my mind, the Ryder Cup has got many, 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 many years of own the President's Cup. It could be that one day the President's Cup has the same sort of feel to it, but I'm not sure. felt as though it was a stronger feeling inside as a player to be on the Ryder Cup team than it was the President's Cup.
And then also looking at your career when you kind of had your resurgence in the mid-90s to the early 2000s, what changes in your golf game got you back to that elite level, or what kind of work or what sort of transpired to get back to the top at that age, which is tougher to do on the PGA Tour?
Well, in my case, I waited till late in life to ever have any kids. My daughter was born at, I was 38 years old, and if I hadn't resurged my career, they would have never seen what I did or how I did it or anything else. And I really wanted them to be able to see how their dad used to play golf. And, you know, I a lot of focus, a lot of direction with a plan and some wisdom that went along with it, knowing that no one knew perfect, like the world wanted to tell everybody that. You watch that in today's game. You know, everybody runs who the current greatest player is taking lessons from, as if that guy has some magic dust that he can sprinkle on them. And honestly, you know, as a teacher, everybody wants to hook their wagon to an engine. And the engine is always the performer, never the guy in the background. And, you know, I finally came to grips with that and understood that principle at a much deeper level. And so I basically surrounded myself with the people that I thought were part of my team. And I said, okay, this is what we need to do. And I didn't look for outside help. I didn't think that someone had a better answer. I relied on what I knew and what my team members knew. And I went after it like that. And that's the way I tell every kid that they need to approach it. You know, there's no leaf that you can turn over that has all the answers underneath it.
And also on your resurgence in your career during that time period, you won a lot of golf tournaments when the best player in the world was playing at his peak, and you got to see it up close. How good was Tiger? I mean, I know he's great, but I mean, even as another touring pro watching it, how truly great was he in that 1999 to 2001 era when you saw it up close? Was it the best you ever saw?
Yeah, it was. I mean, he was nobody moves the needle in golf more than Arnold Palmer. And honestly, it's certainly well worth it because he earned it. I mean, he assembled essentially his, and he worked at it diligently every day and didn't try to find or seek world balance. He saw his own balance. And, you know, basically whenever Tiger had achieved everything that he wanted to, and after his dad had passed away, you know, Tiger started seeking the world's balance a little bit. And because of that, that's when things started to go right for him. But during that time that you're talking about, I don't believe there's ever been anybody that ever touched a golf club that could do any more with it than Tiger Woods could do with it.
Which brings us to the 2000 Players Championship. I imagine that victory has to mean a ton to you because, A, you beat Tiger down the stretch. It's a great golf course against arguably the best field in golf. That had to be a crowning achievement for your career, if you could comment on that.
Yes, you know, I led that one from start to finish, too. And I was really, really playing well, and I knew I was playing well, and I knew that that was Tiger. Nobody was playing any better than Tiger was, and I knew that he had to play TPC the same way I did, from point A to point B to point C. And I didn't feel like at that time anybody did it any better than I did, basically. So, you know, I was on top of my game on the right golf course at the right time. And, you know, I had the confidence to do that. And, you know, when you pull all that together and do it, it is a proud moment for you.
Well, and on top of that, you changed the lexicon of golf forever. I mean, you've got a generation of people, me included, if you, the ball's going at the pin, we're all yelling, be the right club, be the right club today, right? I mean, it's crazy how that one statement from that great tournament has, what, almost 20 years later, right? I'm sure you still have people asking you about that all the time of, you know, it's a phrase that's going to be in golf forever at this point, I think. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. That is pretty cool. You know, that was just a moment of passion. And everybody asked me all the time, had you ever said that before in your life? And no, I mean, it's easy. I had perfect yardage, perfect club, all in the air. It's right at the flag. And all I'm thinking is, don't let something I can't control take it away. You know, a puff wind, a bad bounce, anything. I knew all stars had lined up with what I had done. It was just a moment of passion.
Yeah, like I said, it's a cool thing. Like I said, I'm sure, you know, like I said, you'd asked all the time, but I hear people say it, I say it as well. You don't even think about it now. You just do the, you know, be the right club today. It's pretty cool how that stuck around from that tournament all these years. In 2007, you won the Payne Stewart Award. And my question is, how rewarding has it been to give back and do a lot of charity work? And what did Payne's friendship mean to you throughout the years?
Well, to me, winning the Payne Stewart Award is kind of, it's when you transform from selfish to doing things. And, you know, in order to be super successful in anything, there has to be a certain amount of selfishness or you can't achieve that. And so when you transform into someone that cares more about other things in life, you know, that's, to me, that's what it's about. Payne, he was a great friend. We spent a lot of years on tour together. And, you know, what a lot of people don't know is the lockers on the tours. And alphabetically, the only time that might be in the same area is when one of you is a past champion and another isn't. But, you know, Stewart and Sutton were side by side. So for 20 some odd years, Payne and I, you know, side and knew Payne very, very well. And, you know, the 99 Ryder Cup was 30 days before he was killed. And so 99 Ryder Cup meant a lot because of, not just because we came from way behind and won, or it was the only time I ever played on a victorious team. It was some of the last time that I ever spent on a personal level with Payne. So it was a big week, you know.
I can imagine. The next questions I have, and we'll wrap this up here in a few minutes, are just kind of lighthearted questions or whatever kind of comes to your mind. And obviously there's no right or wrong answer. So my first one is, who are some of the most interesting people you have gotten to meet because of the game of golf?
You know, in the game of golf, you never dream you'd play with presidents. I played with presidents. I met presidents, had dinner with presidents. You know, I played with Dirty Harry and, you know, all sorts of actors and actresses. You know, it's just you never dream that you would be in – with people like that. And I can't think of, you know, Clint Eastwood, Bob Hope. I had one pairing where I was paired with Gerald Ford, Bob Hope, and Barry Goldwater. That's pretty outstanding.
That's an interesting group.
Yeah.
That's an interesting group. If you could pick three PGA Tour players or Champions Tour players and go play a round of golf, play a little money game and have dinner afterwards, which three guys would you take and why do you like those guys so much?
I'd just pick my friend, you know. I'd probably pick Nick Price and Larry Mize and Tom Lehman, you know. Those are three of my really good friends. So, you know, if I had, if I would get asked this quite a bit, you know, if you could have any foursome in the world that you ever wanted, you being one of them, who would be the three people that you would pick to play golf with, past, present, or whatever? You know, I was always admired Ben Hogan's game, and I'd really like to play with him. And, you know, my idol growing up was Jack Nicklaus. And then the third person would be my dad, probably. And he was not a very good player, but, you know, just to share that experience with him.
Well, that's a pretty good choice as well. I ask that question to every touring professional who's been on, and dad comes up as a, like, can I bring in a fifth? You know, can I have my dad go with? So that's a fairly common answer, and I'd be in the same way. I always ask people the best golf shot they ever hit under pressure, but I kind of know what your answer is on that one. Is there a second best golf shot that you can recall that under the gun, under the pressure in a tournament that you pulled off that was pretty darn good?
Well, when I beat Vijay Singh at the Tour Championship at East Lake, I hit it in the playoff about 3.5 feet above the hole on 18 there, the par three. That was one of the best shots I ever hit in my life under pressure.
And the last question I have for you, what, in your opinion, are the three best golf courses in the world, and what makes them so great architecturally?
That's a good question. I'm going to say Wingfoot because I think it's one of the hardest golf courses I've ever played. I'm going to say Pebble Beach because it's one of the prettiest golf courses I've ever played. And the third golf course, I'm probably going to say St. Andrews because of the history.
That's three pretty good ones right there. Well, I appreciate your time so much for being on, Hal. It's you've had an incredible career. It's really cool what you're doing with the teaching and everything. And like I said, I appreciate it, and I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for being on.
Yes, sir. Thank you.